This is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Simon Cooper, who is an author whose most recent book has created quite a stir. It's called Soccernomics, and it's co-authored with Stefan Zemanski. And he is also the author of the book Football Against the Enemy, quite a classic, actually, in football literature from the past few decades. And he also writes frequently for the Financial Times on sports and global football. Welcome to the People's Game, Simon Cooper.
Thank you.
I would be remiss if I didn't start out by saying, and there are many works of soccer football literature that have inspired us here on the People's Game, obviously Galliano's Soccer in Sun and Shadow, but the actual genesis of this show really came about through Jennifer Doyle, Jonathan Majan, and I talking about the book Football Against the Enemy. Having said that, it might be the work of Simon Cooper's that we will touch on the least in this interview, as we'll talk about Soccernomics and another book, by the way, that he wrote called Ajax, The Dutch, The War. And that is a book, obviously, about Dutch soccer. Simon Cooper, I can't really figure a way to tie in Football Against the Enemy in relationship to the finals. Maybe you see something there in terms of Holland versus Spain. I think you'd have to go back to, say, the 16th century. One empire sort of followed the others. I consider that to be something of a stretch. But what I do see is in Spain and the issues of unity within Spain, do you see anything that relates to that, the kind of central thesis of that book in relationship to what seems to be not as much regional antagonism afflicting the Spanish side?
Well, I keep writing extra bits of Football Against the Enemy, if you like. I write them as columns in the Financial Times, where I try and write about football and politics, football and society, which is what that first book was about. And when Spain won Euro 2008, I sort of said, what does this mean for Catalans and Basques in this supposedly very divided country? Everyone was out on the streets. There was very large support and viewing figures for Spain and Catalonia and the Basque country. And if you looked at a lot of surveys that have been done, particularly in Catalonia, they show that people consistently report feeling both Catalan and Spanish. So the two identities are not exclusive. People insist on being Catalan, but there's very few people who are Catalan only. And you saw that come out in Euro 2008 with a largely Catalan side, which Spain also now have, many players born and raised in Barcelona. They play for Spain, and they're the best in the world. And it seems that what Catalans feel is pride in both identities, and that's why they can be on the streets, as they were in 2008, and as they will be tomorrow, singing for Spain. And so I think that through soccer, you see that aspect of Spain very clearly. And that's the way I've always tried to look at soccer, as a sort of lens onto society. Soccer very rarely changes the world, but it's a very good way of looking at the world.
And, of course, for those people who aren't familiar with the longer history of Spanish club football, there really have been two dominant sides, and they have reflected the regional antagonism. And oftentimes have been expressions of it between Real Madrid, a Castilian team, a team that traditionally was supported by General Franco, if you go back far enough, and Barcelona, obviously in Catalonia, and to some extent that kind of political flavor to the two sides still holds true to this day. Do you believe that, or do you think it's just now lessened to such a considerable degree? You wrote, by the way, Soccer Against the Enemy in 1994-95, and at that time you had quite a section about Barcelona.
Yeah, and what I found is what I still find in Barcelona, which is a city that I visited then when I was writing the book for the first time, and luckily I've since got to know much better because it's a brilliant place to go to, as people will know. Mm. And what I found is that Barcelona does proclaim this Catalan identity very proudly, and it's more than a club. As the motto goes, it's the bearer of Catalanism. But it's a Catalanism that sits well with Spanish identity as well. So it's always knocking at Spain and against Real Madrid and against Spanish centralism. But if Catalans had truly wanted independence, they would have got it, or they would have tried to get it. And they haven't. I mean, the history of Spain since Franco is Catalans existing quite happily within Spain, but always asserting their difference. And I think that's what Barcelona, the club, is for. FC Barcelona is a way of saying, we are Catalans, we are different, we are not like Madrid, but without going to the trouble of creating their own state, which Catalans mostly don't want.
Well, right now, of course, we have this marvelous circumstance in the relationship between Dutch football, Dutch total football, FC Barcelona, the Spanish side, and, of course, the Dutch national side squaring off in the finals. But even before we get there, I suppose we should clarify that for people who aren't that familiar, again, with the club sides who are listening, this Spanish side, I really see its central core to an overwhelming degree to be from FC Barcelona, right? You have, even though Xavi Alonso and Sergio Ramos play for Real Madrid, with Xavi and Iniesta, Puyol and Pique, David Villa is joining the club, so maybe he doesn't really count. But with those four players, I really see this Spanish side as an extension of the style of play that FC Barcelona has used in recent years. And in many respects, it's just sort of additions to that core. Do you see it the same way?
Yeah, I see it as a largely FC Barcelona team. I agree that the dominant players who set the style are made in Barcelona. But I'd go further and I'd say that it's a style made in Holland originally.
Right.
Because Johan Cruyff is the father of Dutch soccer, came to Barcelona with the other father of Dutch soccer, Venus Michels, at the start of the 70s. And they taught the Spanish Dutch passing total football. And when Cruyff came back as manager to Barcelona in the late 80s, he reinstituted that. Later they had a succession of Dutch coaches. And so it's very, very much become a Dutch club in its philosophy. Soccer is about passing, about positioning, about where do I stand. It's not about physique or about speed or about passion. It's like soccer is a kind of chess, not soccer is a kind of wrestling. And so the Barcelona style, which has become the Spanish style, was originally the Dutch style. And so Holland, Spain tomorrow is, in a sense, Holland versus Holland. And the irony is that the Spaniards are more Dutch in their style of play now than the Dutch are.
Right, which, of course, revolves around Johan Cruyff. We had David Winter on the show with a fantastic extended interview. He has written the book Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. And in speaking to David Winter, and this was about 10 days ago, he did mention that he, in writing this book, spoke to many of the great Dutch stars, but didn't ever get to have an interview with the greatest of Dutch stars, Johan Cruyff. And beyond moving down to FC Barcelona in the 70s, he, of course, then became the coach in 1988. And right now, he's really in the sort of he's almost sitting in the center of the world right now. As there's now finally in the past few days been an incredible amount of media about Cruyff and his influence both on Dutch soccer and the Barcelona side, and hence the Spanish side. Just curiously, have you ever been able to interview Johan Cruyff?
I did 10 years ago, and of course he was my childhood hero. So you know, it was an enormous thrill. But two things happened. One is that Cruyff stopped thinking like a lot of people when they retire. He stopped coaching in 96 and stopped thinking about soccer soon thereafter. His views became frozen. And so Dutch soccer has since been updated by other thinkers who sort of followed in his footsteps, Louis van Gaal and Guus Hiddink. And the other thing is that we had a conflict after the interview. I won't bore people with details, but anyway, it was he thought I was trying to rip him off for money, which is a thought that Cruyff often has. And he is the inventor of what the Dutch call the conflict model, the idea that conflict inside a team is good because it gets everybody thinking and gives them something to prove. So he's not the easiest of people, and I left the experience with him less of a fan than I had been before.
Yes, he does seem to be quite the prickly and contradictory and contrarian fellow. And he finally did, of course, say that it did start out with his heart, as always, with Holland, then a butt, and then went on to praise the Spanish side, as people maybe would have expected him to, as you also sort of insinuated, that this current Spanish side is sort of playing a purer form of total football. So let's now look at your take on the Dutch side, and I do believe you are a Dutch partisan, correct?
That's true. I grew up there. My dad got a job there, so I lived there for 10 years of my childhood.
And what do you make of the current Dutch side? Because there's been much criticism from the domestic press in Holland that even though they've reached the final, especially in the earlier part of the tournament, I can only imagine that the criticism has died down now that they've reached the final for the third time in the national side's history of the World Cup. What do you make of the team in terms of the two holding defensive midfielders, a somewhat more conservative approach, a more pragmatic approach? What's your sense of the style of play they're using, and is it a corruption of total football?
I mean, people have been noting that Holland now play like Germany and Germany play more like Holland. And so we've lost the moral superiority in soccer that we always had. You know, we played the peaceful game. Other people didn't, and they cheated. And so although we lost, we went home the moral victors. That's largely gone. And even in Euro 2008, we played the most beautiful football for two games. Holland demolished Italy and France. Mm. And then we went out early. So the tradition of glorious defeats extends until 2008. So that's really the founding tradition of Dutch soccer, glorious defeat, beginning in 1974.
Right.
And after 2008, people said, you know, we've kind of had enough of losing. It would be nice to have an inglorious victory. And the whole philosophy of this side is inglorious victory. We kick, we defend, we punt the ball out of defense. We hope that Arjen Robben, our resident genius, will have one moment of inspiration. So, yeah, I mean, in some ways the tradition has been debased. But there is a lot still in the tradition that you still see that Rinus Michels, if he returned, you know, from heaven, he would recognize a lot. There's the, we pass more intelligent than anyone else. We understand positioning better than anyone else. I say better than anyone else except Spain, I should say. Mm. And so the idea that soccer is largely passing and positioning still survives, but now Holland do it from a defensive position rather than by trying to have the ball and dominate games.
I suppose this is on tape delay. I could lose my license by saying that as we're talking, I'm watching the Uruguay-Germany match. I could do play-by-play, and I think FIFA would swoop in and steal our radio license. But Uruguay just missed a good opportunity at the beginning of the second half. I'm speaking with Simon Cooper. He writes for the Financial Times. He's the author of a series of marvelous books, Football Against the Enemy from the 1990s, most recently a book that could conceivably have a tremendous influence on the immediate future of international football called Soccernomics, and we'll get to that in a couple minutes. And a book you wrote in between was entitled Ajax, the Dutch, the War, Football in Europe During the Second World War. I want to maybe segue in a second to Soccernomics through the prism of the club Ajax, but before we get there, since we have been talking about Holland and Spain, would you tender a prediction for tomorrow?
My firm prediction is that Spain wins.
And how do you think that will be received in the Dutch media? Because in a sense, Holland could be it's a little bit of torment. I mean, they're looking at a more beautiful version of themselves in the mirror. And at the very moment that they go for, as we were just talking about, you know, seeking victory pragmatically, less beautifully, and then they're facing the final with their, you know, their beautiful, countenance.
I mean, it would be very painful to lose three finals. Is beyond carelessness, and it would be very hard to emotionally recover from. You'd start to get the sense that we're doomed never to win a World Cup. But on the other hand, you could say, look, this is a country of 16 million people.
Right.
I know Uruguay won two World Cups, but that was, you know, in the caveman era a million years ago.
Mm.
In the modern era, no other country with 16 million people has come close, and Holland would have been in three World Cup finals in the last 10 World Cups. It's an astonishing achievement. I mean, yes, it would be very painful, but you still have to say that per capita, the Netherlands has the healthiest football culture going.
So let's look a little bit more closely at the domestic Dutch scene. And again, I want to sort of use Ajax, contemporary Ajax, as a prism to segue into your most recent work, Soccernomics, most recent book. Ajax has an incredible history, and it's been certainly one of the great clubs in the history of post-World War II European football. It would be on the very short list, no doubt, both as the place where total football was developed, three consecutive European championships, and then a number of great runs in European club, Europe-wide club competitions since the early 70s. However, in this past decade, it has been largely, on account of money and global finance factors, it's been reduced to a top club in a minor league that can't really compete with the top clubs. First of all, is that your impression of where Ajax is today? And is there anything that is in, you think maybe within the brain trust of Ajax to try to revive it back into the top clubs within Europe?
It's not really possible because soccer is determined.
Diego Forlan just got goal number 5, and it's 2-1.
Oh, wow.
Uruguay.
Soccer is determined by finance and TV finance in particular. The Dutch TV market is too small to provide much money.
Mm.
So Ajax loses its best players to export. And if you look at, you know, you could compose a brilliant world-beating team of Ajax old boys, of guys they had as teenagers, from Van der Ferre and Sneijder and De Jong to Zlatan Ibrahimovic, Christian Kivu, Steven Pina, etc., etc. Ajax is a wonderful producer of talent, second in the world only to FC Barcelona. But as an actual first team, yes, it is a little bit disappointing, shall we say, and 50,000 people show up every weekend in Amsterdam to be disappointed in you.
And again, you think there's just no way it can reverse. What's the club ownership structure of Ajax?
It's a members club, I guess a bit like FC Barcelona. So you don't have a Roman Abramovich figure pouring in billions, but I mean, frankly, nobody could be bothered to pour in huge amounts of money because the Dutch league is not very photogenic, and it just doesn't attract the Abramoviches of this world.
Is there disappointment in it due to the fact that, you know, for three decades it competed as one of the top clubs in Europe, and now it's reduced to the place it is now, sort of in the second tier of European club?
Yeah, I mean, there's disappointment. The chairman gets blamed, and there's a huge amount of backbiting and complaining. And certainly, I mean, my own take is that Ajax should be number one in Holland, which they're not. They haven't won a title since 2004, which is just ridiculous and poor management. But the idea that Ajax could compete with Manchester United, or should be able to compete with Manchester United and Real Madrid, is just fantasy. I mean, soccer is determined by finance. We show that very clearly in Soconomics, right, that the wage bill of your team predicts very closely where your team will finish. And given that the best players have the highest wages, Manchester United is always going to have better players than Ajax.
So let's turn now directly to Soccernomics, a fascinating book. And before we talk about how it looked at the World Cup and provided some prognostication and how then things turned out, fitting the thesis or not, there are two things about the book I want to talk about with you to start. One is the general thesis of it, but secondarily, this notion, and you cite at the beginning of the book, the way that American baseball was transformed as a sort of science of looking at the game grew into vogue starting in the late 80s into the 90s, and now it's extremely influential, and that that is just starting to take place in soccer, and that this book is sort of blazing a path in that respect. The general thesis, and then how you think that if this kind of thinking could take off, it could transform the sport.
I mean, the general idea was, yes, soccer has been run on gut and on tradition and on the way, this is the way we've always done it. And it's run by men whose claim to run the game is that they played it when they were kids and played it well, and therefore they're now allowed to run clubs. And we said, you know, and people then talk about it in bars and say this coach is bad and the team lost because the coach is bad. And we said, well, we're going to take all this traditional thinking and test it against cold, hard data and see what we come up with. And so, for example, one thing we found is that coaches are much less important than people think because players' wages determine almost everything. And it was only while we'd begun writing Soconomics that I read Moneyball, so it was post-facto. Mm. But I did read it and think, wow, Billy Beane, who I've since got in contact with, who's a soccer fan, Billy Beane was trying to think about soccer, baseball in the same way that we are trying to think about soccer, sort of arrive from Mars, if you like, take a cold, hard look at the game from the outside and say, this doesn't make sense.
And, you mentioned also at the beginning Bill James, a person who's had such a huge influence in transforming American baseball. Much in the same way you describe as football as being run by men who played it, this was very much the case of baseball. And this has had just an absolute transformational effect on the sport of baseball. In fact, a disciple of James's became the head of the Boston Red Sox and in all of American sports, the biggest curse that existed was overturned by the science of baseball by Theo Epstein, the general manager of Boston, his design with sort of James over his shoulder. And then James was actually literally brought in the game was transformed. It's now 2-2 as Germany has equalized Uruguay. It's the open flowing game that you get in these third place games without close up playing, which is very interesting, by the way. In the game of soccer, though, it does seem could really be transformed by this kind of thinking. And do you have any sense now in the wake of the book being published last year that people may be taking this on?
A little bit. I mean, we've had some conversations with people in clubs who at least have taken on board what we say and have thought about it. And I can actually say that Soconomics, we're trying to set up a consultancy, me and Steph and a couple of other people. And we gave some penalty advice in a knockout game to one of the teams at the World Cup. I'm not at liberty yet. I can only say after the World Cup exactly which team it was.
Sure.
But so we're starting to make small inroads into soccer. And through this consultancy, we hope to make more. Because, I mean, we do think that we could save clubs from some errors I mean, for example, Ajax, which is the club I follow most closely, last year bought a 19-year-old Serbian forward for 16 million euros. And the guy is now a reserve. And I would have said to Ajax, look, okay, I didn't play soccer. I played soccer, but I didn't play professional soccer. But I can tell you this guy is not going to be worth, 16 million euros. It's just a crazy investment. But they made it because the guy who made it, the coach then, was the greatest player in Holland after Johan Cruyff, Marco van Basten. So van Basten said, let's spend 60 million on this kid, and they did. And so those sorts of dumb errors, which are based on following somebody because he was a good soccer player once, I think we would stop them making. And we would say, don't sack your coach every 6 months because it just costs a lot of money, causes disruption, and the coach is not why you're losing. The coach is much less important than you think, et cetera, et cetera. Or you can stop penalties if you analyze how people actually took penalties in the past, not just looking at their penalties on video, but using statistical tests. So I think there's a lot that could very quickly be improved.
Yeah, no, in baseball, you know, all of this analysis didn't really produce any slowing down of the game. In fact, a big offensive boom followed the greater influence of this, and it transformed the way that people especially approached base on balls and being patient hitters and getting on base and producing more offense, however pragmatically possible. In soccer, though, when I look at this World Cup, and we can segue now into talking about soccernomics and its view of the World Cup going, you say some things about what to expect. Some of them have seemed quite prescient. But right now we are faced with this sort of holding midfielder, two holding midfielder style. And is it possible that the science of soccer will produce this kind of effort to have a kind of defensive clutch on the game?
Well, I mean, soccernomics is slightly more how you run a club and off the field and the trends in how globalization changes who wins matches.
Right.
What I think you see on the field is something else that we sort of, I would say, predicted, which is that the marginal soccer countries, the emerging countries, the US, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, say, how come we're getting interested in soccer because of cable TV? People like yourself in all these countries around the world, we want our team to be better at soccer. We don't have Brazilian quality players. So what we're going to do is we're going to copy how the Europeans defend because they do it best. And so we're going to gain their fitness. We're going to gain their discipline. We're going to work on different defensive systems. And then you see a team like New Zealand or the US, not great players, very well organized, comes to the World Cup, fit, and gets quite a few points. And I think what you see with these emerging countries like your own is that it creates soccer of the lowest common denominator. The easiest thing to do is organize a defense and be fit. And so these teams do that. So it's not very pretty to watch.
Right.
But, if you're New Zealand, that's the way to get points in the World Cup. And so not everybody can produce a Messi, but you can produce an organized defense, and that's what we saw at this World Cup.
And obviously the sort of headline-grabbing aspect of soccernomics going into the World Cup was this thesis about big countries, countries with large GDP, and then given the fact that you're writing in English, the book was published in English, and there's so much press with the English national team, your sense of how they perform in the World Cup and fail at the World Cup. So just two things. How much did you watch the English side and say, told you so? That's the first question. The second question, what do you think about how this has played out in terms of that general thesis with countries with large GDP eventually developing into soccer powerhouses?
Before the World Cup, our book in England, as you say, was called Why England Lose. Before the World Cup, it didn't sell brilliantly in England because nobody wanted to read a book called Why England Lose. As soon as they were eliminated, and they were eliminated in exactly the fashion that we said they always eliminated in, they play a former wartime enemy expecting to win the World Cup. They have this piece of freakish bad luck that they think could only have happened to them. In this case, Frank Lampard's wrongly disallowed goal. They get knocked out. Then they find foreign scapegoats. In this case, Fabio Capello and the Uruguayan linesman who didn't see the goal went in. And then this period of hysteria, life returns to normal at home. Everyone goes merrily on, and then they go to the next World Cup thinking they'll win it. So we didn't say that would happen this time. We just sketched the normal ritual of elimination. As it happened, that ritual was followed to the letter this time. And so people said, wow, you know, how did you know England would lose and how did you know they would lose to a former wartime enemy? And I thought that was just history. And the idea in England in the months before the World Cup that they were very likely to take home the trophy, that was the ludicrous idea. The other half of your question, how do the predictions stand up? I mean, the thing is that population size, wealth, and soccer experience do predict a lot, but they don't predict everything because some countries massively overperform historically. Brazil does much better than it should, and some, like the U.S., massively underperform.
Right.
But the one continent that truly lived up to that description was Africa, and we said there's no way African countries can do well because of poverty, and also most of them are too small. And so the failure of African sides here, although sad, was entirely to be expected. I mean, as I say, Western Europe had this huge advance in tactical know-how. Other countries are doing their best to catch up. The Western European countries that haven't kept learning, particularly England and Italy, are suffering. I mean, once New Zealand starts to learn football tactics, New Zealand turns out not to be worse than Italy. And but the Western European countries that keep exchanging information and tactical know-how with each other, particularly Spain, Holland, and Germany, they reign supreme. I mean, the exchange of tactical know-how that happens in European soccer really twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and coaches and players crossing borders all the time, that's impossible, for example, for Americans to replicate. You're just not, at the moment, part of that network of exchange. And so Spain and Holland and Germany retain a significant lead over anyone else because they're doing that exchange.
Well, it's an utterly fascinating book. I tracked this particular guru in American baseball's rise to prominence, Bill James. I think you guys are right on the tip. I really do believe that soccer clubs around the world should get this book and read it, and I think that national soccer programs could also benefit from it because there's just a lot of insight. And you do talk about it being off the field, but at times you talk about things that directly relate to the field, in particular the secrets of AC Milan to keep their players vital, you know, well into their dotage. So, Simon Cooper, I thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game, and enjoy tomorrow's finals.
Thanks. Pleasure to speak to you, Alan.